welcome, my friends. I'm Dave Champion, and this is my co-host, Bill Carnes, and together we are totally unprepared. Well, Bill, let's jump right into it today. You and I were talking a little bit at lunch. Again, we're totally unprepared, so we just sat at lunch and decided this was something that irked us, and we're going to talk about it. The subject is government inspections of businesses and the cost and consequence to business the way it's being handled now. I think anyone who's in business, anybody who has friends or relatives in business, know how obnoxious the inspection process is now. And pretty much this is how it works. You call in, you say, hey, I've got a restaurant or I've got a business I want to open. I'm Walmart. It doesn't matter. I've got a building that has been constructed and I want to inspect it. Fire inspection, you name it. All right. Healthcare facility. You call up and say, I need it inspected. And then you wait. And wait. And wait. And sooner or later, someday, an inspector comes.
And oftentimes, when you just left to go to the office supply store to grab a few things, you come back and now there's a note on the door. Right.
And you're done, by the way. Here you've got this arc of, you know, going from I don't have a business to I have a business that's open. You're stuck right here until that inspector arrives. And the main gist of this, and we'll get into specifics in a little while, but the main gist of this, Bill, is, of course, it seems like we've got come to such an arrogant place in government where the inspectors just don't give a damn anymore. They'll get there when they get there, and if you go broke waiting for them, the hell with you.
Yeah, their job's secure. What do they care?
Yeah.
And I believe, in some cases, that might actually even be a ploy.
How do you mean?
Well, there's a local business owner that I know here, town okay. we live in, Pahrump, who closed down to do some maintenance and some repair, then needed to get reinspected before it could open back up. And it's literally been playing games for weeks on end. He finally opened, got everything together. Playing games for weeks on end, inspectors, you know, not being responsive, not wanting, they don't care. He had to sell one of his vehicles in order to continue to pay his bills to stay afloat during this time.
Now, if I understand the story correctly, and I think I know who you're talking about. If I understand the story correctly, he kind of came to the point where it was go out of business or open without the inspector's sanction, and that's now caused some drama, and they're claiming that he violated the law.
Yep.
Okay. Which is exactly the point we're talking about. And that is that the inspectors don't care if they bankrupt the business, they'll get there when they get there.
Yeah.
Now, it's very important to remember that I'm not just saying this about government inspectors. This applies to government generally. People who work for government are tax consumers. They eat tax money up. The people who generate that tax money are us in the private sector. Okay. And I've often characterized government when it comes to, economically speaking, we, the productive part of society, we are the host. These government douches are the parasite. And they latch on and they bleed us and they bleed us and they bleed us. And in this particular case, speaking of inspections, they can simply sit back and do nothing. And watch you fail.
Dave, I've always been of the opinion of act now, do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. Don't ask permission, ask forgiveness if it comes back. Always been that way.
Yeah.
I've got stuff to do, and I don't need to wait on inefficient people who can't seem to get out of their own way. Mm-hmm. I just don't have time for it. And if it comes up later, hey, you know what? I needed to get some stuff done. I don't have time for these inefficient people, you know. If that's the case, hey, sorry, slap on the wrist, let's carry
right.
on.
Now, we've all seen the thing, like on a road crew. This is the most common thing you hear people comment about. You know, there's four guys leaning on shovels.
The shovel leaner. It's a good job. It's right. actually a description, shovel leaner.
And there's one guy, like, pointing. Perhaps there's somebody shoveling. Perhaps. Okay. They're all getting paid. Perhaps there's somebody shoveling. And this is always how government works.
Now, sure. Absolutely.
When we talk about these inspections, Bill, the way the system is structured today, what incentive is there for an inspector to act timely and responsibly concerning that inspection?
As far as I know, Dave, there's none, which is why I don't think they should exist.
Right. I'm with you.
My solution is that all of this should be private enterprise. If you need to have a fire inspection, a health inspection, a safety inspection, whatever kind of inspections, you can have private companies or private individuals go through some sort of a sanctioned, formatted training course that requires recertification just so often. And you go in there, and then you can go out into the world. You're licensed, you're bonded, you're insured, and there's several of you. And in the town that we live in, where there's just shy of 40,000 people, this sort of thing would be great because there's just so many inspectors. In a big city, there might be more inspectors, there might be less. It all depends on the health of the local government.
Right.
And how much tax they're soaking you for, so how many of these douches, as you put it, are actually on the payroll. Get rid of all of that. Put these people in the private sector. Allow you or I or anybody else to become an inspector. Somebody could be a fire inspector, a health inspector, and say a safety code inspector, all in one. Mm-hmm. You call these guys up, hey, I need somebody to come inspect. I'm opening a pastry shop. And they can come out there. They could do all those various inspections, keep changing
that
their hats and forms.
Was that Pack Your Fudge? No, that was an ice. That was a brownie shop.
Yeah, that was a candy store.
Candy
store, yeah. Yeah, the fudge bakery. something they're opening in Northern California, the Bay Area. Anyhow, they could change their hats, you know, do all the inspections, take photographs, document everything.
Right.
And then they can submit that on behalf of the – or they don't even need to submit it. From there, they can sign off and hand it to the business owner. You're ready to go.
Right.
Private industry, private people, call them on the phone. They're there in an hour or two. You're not waiting for days or weeks on end.
And historically, there's been some objection to that. And I think we can overcome those objections in the following ways. You mentioned photography, okay? Make sure there's photographs.
Okay? Oh, yeah, because we're not dealing with film anymore. We're dealing with digital things and devices that hold literally multiple gigabytes. There's right. actually a half terabyte thumb drive now.
So the way this would work to get past the common historical objections to this would be when an inspector arrives, he walks around, runs a video. So everything that he's seeing is being seen on video. There's no like, well, I didn't see that. Well,
yeah, you know, he can even wear like the Google glasses
right,
or something. Everything he looks at,
there you go.
Take care of this.
Like a body cam, but
exactly.
Yeah, okay. So there's a record. Everything he looked at is on video. So he can't say, I didn't see it. You looked right at it. Okay. Everything specific, if he says, well, you got to change that, that gets still photographs. And then the same process is repeated when the inspector comes back.
If need be, yes.
Well, to have a photographic record that the work was actually done.
Right. I'm sorry. We were on the difference of opening a new business versus if you need to get reinspected for something else. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Everything documented.
Now, then the agency, let's say the State Attorney General's office, has an inspector.
Like an inspector general.
Correct.
Yeah.
Who goes out to these hundreds or thousands of private inspectors and does random checks. He shows up. He says, by the way, Bill, next Tuesday I'm going to be at your place. I need you there at 1 in the afternoon. He shows up and says, I'm going to check 12 of your files randomly. This is presuming he doesn't have a complaint to begin with. Okay. I'm going to check 12 of your files randomly. He pulls them out. He has they're on whether it's flash drive, you know, CD-ROM, whatever, there's the video of the business, shows him looking at the sign, walking in the door, he watches the entire inspection, he looks at the still photographs, he looks at the documentation, everything matches up, okay, that you did that job correctly. If he finds problems, he has the ability to correct the problems, to incentivize the correction through fines and whatnot of these licensed parties, so we know that privatizing it doesn't turn into a problem.
Yeah, there needs to be some oversight. I'm just a little concerned with what any sort of punishments or penalties would be, how far the government would be willing to go on it. It needs to be set, see how it goes, and if there's a problem, that industry of all those inspectors collectively should get together and decide, this will fix our industry.
Yeah,
you're an inspector, I'm an inspector, he's an inspector, Noah's an inspector, everybody's an inspector, and we should collectively be able to figure out how to keep each other in line.
Yeah. Now, the other alternative is to keep it within government, and one way to tackle that would be to set a designated time. So let's say I'm opening a dental office, and so I need a health inspection. So I contact the health inspectors. The health inspectors have X amount of days. I think at lunch you had thrown out 48 hours. I think I had thrown out a week, okay, to arrive and conduct their initial inspection. If they fail to act within that time, the business can move forward as if the inspection occurred and they passed without problem. In other words, the government has forfeited their ability to inspect if they do not arrive within the statutory time limit. Then if they do arrive within the statutory time limit, they say, all right, Mr. Business Owner, these are the five things you need to correct. Then when the business owner calls up and says, okay, I've corrected those, I'm now ready for my secondary inspection to sign off so I can open my door, again, they have a statutory time frame, 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, to get out there and to sign that off. If they don't make the statutory limit, and there's no excuses why, you don't make the statutory limit, the person is automatically approved, opens their doors, and off they go.
Yeah, and I still, as though that seems to have some merit. I think there can be some issues with it. As many limitations or avenues that you can use to narrow down the way a government employee or government organization needs to work, they'll always find a way out of it. And if they have the ability to say they didn't show up in 48 hours, somebody opens, they go back, oh, these things aren't right, you got to close down again and fix it. I mean, that's open, close, not good for the business. And if you have it privatized...
Well, in my model, they forever lose that if they don't show up. They can't come back later and say shut down.
I get you. Yeah. But if you go privatized and the inspector doesn't show up, you call the competitor, and they'll be there in an hour.
Yeah.
A lot better answer. And far less government employees that are soaking up huge salaries with incredible pensions and golden parachutes.
Forget yeah, and about it does sort of also prevent the government from doing what they've been doing now, which is... Anything you need from the government, they're constantly raising the price because they want more money. Even if it only costs them real dollars, say $25 to conduct an inspection, it's $350 to request the inspection because the agency wants money.
Private industry is virtually always the right answer.
Absolutely.
All right.
All right. So you know this came from several examples in this town.
It
right?
did. Yeah. It did. In this town, small town, it's not
the worst of the worst.
Limited here. Yeah, not limited here.
And we'll be back right after these words. And we are back, and it's now time for... What is up with political correctness moving into the business world? Now, we've all known that our society has been getting more and more politically correct, and you can't say certain things in public. It's just not acceptable. And, of course, in the political arena, media, things like that, except our show and my show, other than that, they have to be very politically correct. But now it's getting into the business world. Now, before I launch on this, I want to let you know that I've always been a small business person. I've never worked for General Motors. I've never worked for Xerox. So I don't have a depth of experience, but I have many good friends that do. And what they tell me stories about things that go on in the workplace and how people interact and what causes problems and where management gets involved. And how they have to sort through issues and problems. Now, perhaps some of this comes from my military background and my law enforcement background and then running my own business operations in an environment where I knew where I wanted to go and this is where we were going to go. This is how we made money. And so this you have to do what I say because my vision, I know what we're here to do if we're going to succeed. Always love to listen to other people, but ultimately, as a small business owner, you're aware of this, the guy who's the owner ultimately has to make the tough calls and everybody has to follow suit. But I've noticed that it seems in corporate America now, not offending anybody is far more important than actually earning money. I don't know whether they want it to be generally publicly known, so I'm not going to mention, but there is a gigantic corporation. Most of you have probably heard the name. They're based out of Las Vegas. And they just pulled the trigger on April 1st on this whole new system of doing business that's out of, I think, Denmark. and there's no more linear chain of command. Now everybody's in these work groups, and all the goals are established together as a committee. All of the decisions about how things are going to be done is established together as a committee. If somebody needs to be corrected, they have a meeting and everybody decides how they're going to correct this person who's not pulling their weight. Now, perhaps I am wrong. I'm the first guy in the world to say I don't have all the answers. How do I know I don't have all the answers? Well, that would be the occasions I've been proven wrong. So I know I don't have all the answers. But it seems to me, in my experience in life, which may be different than yours, that all of this feel-good, warm, fuzzy, committee-oriented stuff, where there is no real leadership, it's all lead by consensus, is not really a practical way to run a business. And, of course, once you get into this whole committee thing, then political correctness takes on an entirely new and different and exponentially greater significance, because now you're not trying to, if you have a linear chain of command, you know that there are certain things that will probably rub your boss the wrong way if you say to your coworkers, so you steer clear of that. Well, now when your boss is the other 13 people in your work group, now you're super constrained about the no, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying people should have complete freedom of speech in the workplace. I think there are constraints that people should impose on themselves when they're in the workplace. However, having to be concerned about what everybody else in your work group thinks of something that may come out of your mouth, because all of them get to judge you and perhaps have a hand in disciplining you, seems to me to be really counterproductive and inane. And I don't understand, here's what this is really coming all around to, I don't understand how that sort of structure or system is really focused on the goal of the business, which is making money. Bill, what do you think about that?
Well, a couple of things. First, I have all the answers. They're not all the right answers, but at least I have answers.
Yes, I'm with you on that one, yeah.
The second thing is this, when we go to break, I'd like you to let me know what that company is, because if we can start a business in competition, we're going to eat their lunch.
All right.
Because this is going to send them down
the tubes. I think I can go ahead and say it. I think they've been public about it. It's Zappos.
Oh, okay. Zappos is doing this.
Yes.
They are a huge company.
Yes.
And they are really big in Las Vegas. Do a lot of community-related things. Do the highway cleanup stuff.
Well, that's where they're based out
of.
Yeah.
And you and I actually know a couple people, whether you know it or not, who work for them.
I know several that I know. I don't know if you know the same ones
I know.
They
know. I know. Well, maybe do they know that we know that they?
Perhaps.
So to do this sort of thing, as you say, it's interesting, because when you are an employee and you have a supervisor, you need to be directly responsible to them. You're going to get your work done. And if the other people in your department don't much care for the way you're doing it or how you're doing it or that you get it done, or maybe you make them look good or bad, now you have to be ultimately concerned about the feelings and interpretations of everybody. You're literally spending way too much, almost your entire day, trying to keep everybody happy, playing kiss ass, if you will, without actually producing squat. Horrible idea.
And your point is very well taken. As an independent contractor, I have been in a position where, working within the construct of a company that's hired me, I have become very unpopular, not for the usual reasons. I have become very unpopular because my work level and my work output and the quality was significantly greater than the people I was working in and around. And so all of a sudden I'm the bad guy and they're like, hey, you need to calm down. You need to slow down. Don't work so fast. What is this? You know, why is this so detailed?
I've been in the same shoes where literally it's like you get to a point you can't do anything anymore. Well, why aren't you working anymore? Well, my work is predicated on these guys getting their stuff done, and here's where they're at. I've surpassed that, and now I'm kicking my feet up on the clock waiting for them to get done because that's the way you design the job.
And then
I could go do it, but you won't let me.
Right.
And then they're pissed off
because... Right. I was going to say, then you're the ass because you said I can't proceed because they're not doing their job.
Yeah.
Which is the truth. And they should have been doing their job, but now they're going to be mad at you because you actually said that.
Yeah. Now it's an organizational committee that decides, oh, this is where our little bubble of a department should float off into...
Right.
Like, seriously?
Now, obviously, the guy that owns his own business and has, I'll just throw out an arbitrary number, 23 people working for him, is not going to adopt this model. It would be economic suicide. And of course, Zappos has more money than it knows what to do with, and obviously more money than is good for it if it's doing this sort of thing. Now, in all credit to the gentleman who owns Zappos, he does a lot of philanthropic work. I mean, if a guy is going to have the kind of money he has, I'm glad that he has the, ethos that he has, that he wants to put back and give back, because he does voluminously. So
I understand this guy is one of the nicest guys in the world.
Yes.
Like, just a really stellar individual who's not all full of himself.
Right.
And if you're going to have anybody who's got a lot of money and they run a powerful corporation, you know, you don't want somebody that goes for the jugular on every single thing. So, you know, that's a good thing.
It is.
But this demonstrates to me a lack of real business focus.
I wonder, and I don't know, and this is presumptuous of me because I'm not in his position looking down with the same considerations he has.
Sure.
But it seems to me that this is a case of I have too much money. And sort of like, here's a good example. What do singers do, right? They struggle and struggle for years, and they finally find a sound that works for them. And overnight, they're multimillionaires, and the next seven songs go platinum. And then suddenly, I want to be more artistic. This is too commercial. And all of a sudden, they turn around and do this stuff. You're like, what is this?
Yeah, they just flush their own career.
Right. It's like, that's not what made you popular. What are you doing?
Mariah Carey's a perfect example. She was huge in the early 90s, had, what, 13 number ones in a row or something,
like that.
And then she ended up moving on and doing some more hip-hop things and got popular in another genre, but nowhere near to the actual success level. But, you know, whatever.
So they commit professional suicide because they get so much money they don't have to care what their customers like anymore.
Right.
It's like, what I want, not what my customers want, which is a death sentence. So I wonder, to draw that parallel, I wonder if that's a little bit of what's going on with Zappos. The guy's made so much money, the company is so soaking rich with money that he can afford to indulge in something that in a smaller company would be automatic death sentence.
The company might have such a high percentage of autopilot income that they can afford to experiment with this. And if that's the case, well, you know what? If you can rewrite the rules of baseball and how that thing works, then go for it. I mean, the Oakland A's tried it back in the early 2000s. It actually changed the face of baseball, how they were putting things together. But, you know, if this guy can experiment some with the business because he's got an 85% revenue regeneration that's just automatic, you know, good for him. Go for it.
I understand that. And, you know, when people throw about numbers, you never know how accurate they are. But remember I said this came out of, I believe it was Denver.
Enron was pretty good, though.
Yeah.
Good numbers.
Yeah. Very reliable. At least the numbers we got in the end were reliable. anyway, I told you this came out of, I believe, a company in Denmark. And the claim is that that company, by adopting the same system that Zappos has now adopted, and I'm not sure exactly how this works, how they would derive this, but the claim was that they saved $2 billion, I don't know whether that's annually or amortized over a period of time, $2 billion in operating costs by changing over to this format. You know, perhaps I'm just not a Harvard business grad, so I'm missing it, but having 13 people make a decision that used to be made by one guy.
What's a Dutch dollar versus, they probably used the euro, right?
They probably did, yeah.
So maybe, I wonder if it's 2 billion, that would be, if it was 2 billion yen, I'm not impressed.
Right.
2 billion pesos, I'm not impressed. I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, you and I have both been in business and done business and understand business, and there's obviously a big part of this that we must be missing.
And I'm a big advocate, by the way, of sounding my people out. I don't have all the answers. Sometimes the people I hire are better or smarter at something than I am.
That's the best sort of boss to have. I'm kind of an understudy of a lot of things Henry Ford did. You know, obviously many years back when he's got Ford going, the Dodge brothers were investors. They sued and said, look, you know, he's reinvesting all this money back into the companies. Investors were not getting any of the dividends. He's paying the employees better. He's hiring more people. And, you know, we want to see some of what is ours. So they led a suit with some of the other investors. in that suit, the Dodge brothers said, look, Henry Ford doesn't even know how to build a car, to which Henry Ford responded, you're right. I don't know how to build a car. I don't need to. I know how to develop the systems to make an affordable car. I hire people smarter than me to get stuff done. I don't need to know how to build the car. And touche.
And, you know, my thing is, while I want to send my people out and make use of them because they're, as I said, sometimes better and smarter or something than I am, I don't want to relinquish that linear chain of command that I think is essential in business.
No, you've got to have somebody that can steer the ship. Folks, we'll be right back. Welcome back. Now let's find out what grinds my gears. You know what really grinds my gears? Silly traditions when you should be paying attention to something else. This week, it's all about this silly wave that motorcyclists like to do, right? You're on your bike, you're riding, another guy or woman, somebody on a bike is coming the other direction, and you give this silly little wave. It goes out, it's down here to the side, like a low five, if you will. Just this little wave. Now, I've ridden bikes, Dave's ridden bikes for many years, and it seems so silly to me that you got to give this little wave as though you're acknowledging the other person on the bike. You know, say if I'm driving a Honda, do I have a special little, you know, two-finger peace salute, or I guess that would be more of a Volkswagen Bug, out the window to everybody else driving a Volkswagen Bug? Or if I'm driving a Dodge Ram, should it be, you know, like the dog pound woof woof sort of a fist symbol? No, just on the motorcycle and here's this silly little wave. You know what? There's a lot of motorcycle accidents out there to begin with. You're really going to take your hand off there to give a silly wave to every other person that's riding a bike? You know the people that seem to do it the most? Women who are riding a motorcycle. They're on the back as a passenger, you'll see them wave off quite often. If they're actually in control of the bike, you see them waving at everything they can wave at. And I tell you the silliest thing. This last Saturday, I was driving into Las Vegas, and I took the scenic route through an area called Red Rock Canyon. Beautiful drive. It's about, I don't know, 18 miles end-to-end or so. And on the weekends, especially on Saturdays, there seems to be several thousand people on bicycles out there. I guess it was Sunday I was driving through there. No, it was Saturday. It was Saturday I was driving through. And there was literally thousands of bicyclists out there. And I started seeing some of them doing the same thing. They're on their little 10-speed out there, road bike, whatever you call it, and they give a little wave to all the other thousands of people riding by them. I don't get it. I really don't. I used to ride bicycles. I used to ride motorcycles. I've been part of these communities, if you will, and I never saw a need to have to wave to them. You know, I drive an Audi. I don't wave to everybody else that I see driving an Audi. I don't see people in Mercedes-Benz waving to the other Mercedes-Benz. You got a Kia? Hey, there's another Kia. I'm going to wave to that guy. You know, what is with this silly tradition, Dave? You've ridden motorcycles. Do you give that wave? Are you part of the waving crowd?
Now and again. If I'm out on the highway and there's like one other guy and I see him do this, I'll do this. But you get these nice days where you've got 500 guys coming this way, and I'm one of the 500 going that way. Forget it. I'm not doing it.
Yeah, you just ride by at, like, you know, a combined 60 miles an hour each direction, 120-mile-an-hour high five across it. Hope you don't fall over, you know.
I got to tell you a funny story, though. Have you met my friend Leonard?
Not that I know.
California. Okay. Black guy. And when I say black, I mean as night. Okay. One of my dearest friends, known him for, I don't know, 25 years. And I lived in Santa Clarita, white bread suburb, right? And then he moved up there with his wife. And he and I were doing a barbecue or something, and we're walking through the grocery store. We're walking down the freezer aisle, and it's me and him chatting away. And here comes, like, the only other black guy in Santa Clarita, right? But Leonard just got there. And as they're passing each other, both of them are like, hey, man, what's up? And so I said to Leonard, I'm like, what is that? And he's like, what? I said, do you know that guy? He's like, no. I said, oh, because we passed a bunch of other people. And you didn't say a word. I said, so, like, if I go to Africa and I'm in a grocery store, there's, like, one other white guy. Is it obligatory for me to be like, you know?
It's funny you bring that up because I was running through my head. I remember a comedian years ago saying he went to visit South Africa. And he like saw somebody else, like it was the only other white person on the street, and they're like, hi.
Yeah. You
know? So,
but I mean, yeah. Same thing. You know, like you said, Mercedes drivers waving to Mercedes drivers, you know, say, yeah. Audi drivers. On this whole motorcycle thing, I mean, I'm not necessarily opposed to it, but I'm going to tell you, on a beautiful spring day, everyone's out on the road, I'm not doing this every 5 seconds. I'm just not doing it.
You know, that's what gets me. It's like, if you want to, like, wave to somebody every now and again, that's fine. It's like the only motorcyclist you've seen in the last 5-6 minutes. That's
right,
cool.
Right.
But some of them are literally, it's like, just, you know, instead of having a handlebar up here, just put a steering wheel up there so you can drive with one hand, and the other one is out here literally just constantly waving. It just seems so silly to me.
Get a prosthesis, like works off like your knee, so you can keep both hands on the wheel, and it's hanging out there. When somebody comes by, you just like wave your knee, and it waves that.
It just seems so silly to me that there. It's like,
oh, and, you know, it's not really a wave, is it?
No, it's just it's
just
cool.
Drop the hand down. Yeah.
Sometimes it's the two-finger piece.
Yeah.
Right? And you're pointing at it with the other hand.
Oh, like, wouldn't that be funny to drive by when people do that instead of giving that, like, hey, I'm cool thing? Be like...
I almost want to drive with my window down and just stick my hand out whenever somebody on a bike has come, just kind of put my hand out.
See if they do it.
Peace, brother. What's up? You know, I don't know.
You have to wear a motorcycle helmet in your Audi when you do that so they can relate.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the full face shield, or should I go with the skull cap?
And then what you make sure you do is kind of lean over so they can see the helmet, and then, you know, put your hand out.
Yeah. My bike's in the shop. Yeah. Getting the oil changed.
That's
back
right,
in the shop.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm relating to you, man, even though I'm in my Audi.
Well, that grind my gears, that's only about half the segment. So there was something else that you and I chatted about at lunch that I want to talk about.
Oh.
And that is about a judge in Pennsylvania.
Oh. Okay.
There's a judge in Pennsylvania.
Are you sure you don't want to save this for the fourth segment? Because this is, I think, a big one.
You think?
Yeah. Why don't we talk about the church and the commercial center thing?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Let's
take more than the time we have left.
That's right. Yeah. Let's hit the church and the commercial center.
You see how unprepared we are?
Totally.
We live up to our name. All right. Here was the deal.
I'm just waving everybody out there in the audience that, you know, rides bikes.
I can't even do it. My hand goes off screen.
It does. That's, and I...
Yeah. I can't even do this with my hands hidden by the table. All right. Here's something that Bill
Not our best show.
No. Perhaps it is. How the hell would we know? You know, sometimes people ask me, like, after I'm done with my show on Monday, so how was the show? I don't know. Sometimes I think I do a fabulous show, and people are like, dude, that was weak. And then other times I'm like, you know, that just didn't really feel like a great show. And people are like, one of the best shows you've ever done. So I can't figure it out.
Yeah.
All right. So here was the thing we were talking about at lunch. A lot of municipalities and counties have ordinances that says that various types of businesses, things like, say, liquor stores, sex shops, things like that, cannot be within X amount of feet or yards of a religious organization like a church or a synagogue.
Okay. Or a school or
schools,
something like that. But
I'm, for the sake of this discussion.
Specifically church,
And Bill and I both disfavor those sort of laws. However, my view is this. Okay, if a church is on a freestanding lot, and it's got a freestanding building, you know, maybe 250 feet. Hell, by the time you measure that out, you're just getting off the parking lot in most cases, right? Not a big deal. However, one of the things that I've noticed that just I think is incredibly unfair to business, okay, is when a church decides to become a, like, storefront church in a commercial shopping
center. A strip mall.
Yes.
Which has gotten really popular over the last even 30 years.
Well, especially since 2008, I've noticed, because the economy's gone to crap, a lot of businesses have gone out, a lot of these shopping centers are running high vacancy rates, so along comes a church, and I think there's probably some tax write-off stuff for the landlord and stuff when it's a religious institution, 501c3 and all that. So they say, okay, yeah, move in. Okay. So now, let's say you've got a mom and pop business in the shopping center, and their plan is to open, and they're going to stay in business 2 or 3 years and establish themselves and pay their taxes and get known by the community and by the government officials there and whatnot. And then when that time comes, then they're going to apply for a liquor license.
Yeah, they're going to expand a little
bit. Right, because, of course, we know alcohol is where the money is in restaurants. If you're doing a good alcohol business, that's probably going to, profit-wise, that's going to trump your food in short order.
Sure.
So that's very, very important from the commercial aspect. So here they move into a commercial shopping center to engage in a commercial activity. While they're there doing their thing, waiting for their 2 or 3 years to be before they apply for their alcohol permit, all of a sudden a church moves in 4 doors down in one of these storefronts. So the business says, okay, we put in our time, now it's time to, everybody knows us, we paid our taxes, we're a known reliable entity, we're going to apply for a liquor license. Oh no. No, 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 no. You can't have a liquor license.
Yeah, you're too close to the church, synagogue, mosque, whatever it is down the way.
Right. And I'm not a religious person, and I have some beefs with what a lot of religion does. This is not what this is about. This is about somebody who's not engaged in a commercial activity. Or is it? Something that's typically thought not to be a commercial activity. How's that? Okay. Saying, I'm going to move in here and I'm going to blunt your commercial success. I think it's reprehensible.
I agree.
It's not the church's fault. Let me be clear about that.
No, it's the laws that are on the books.
It's the legislators. They need to preempt this and say, well, we need to amend this. This is not right.
I would agree. It's interesting. You started to take a slight towards a religion, or is it a business? a very good friend of mine.
Is that subtle enough?
You know him as well as I do. He actually said to me one time, he said, this is about Christianity. He said, Christianity began as a relationship with Jesus Christ. From there, it moved to Greece where it became a philosophy. Then it moved to Rome where it became an institution. Then it came to America where it became a business, and that's when it came to me. It was Gandhi who said, I like your Christ, I just not that fond of your Christians.
Right.
So it's one of those things, where has it molded?
I'm actually reading a book right now written in the 30s by H.L. Mencken, a name you know, called Treatise on the Gods.
Okay.
And one of the things, and he looks at religion in an anthropological sense from like the beginning of mankind through today. And one of the things he says is like we talk about like in the Old Testament, there's the you bring your 10% of your wheat or you bring the young calves.
Your tithings.
Your tithings, right. And he said the only reason they did it that way back then is they hadn't invented money yet. Which is a great observation that I had not thought of. Yes.
I wonder how Islam does it, because I know that, when Muhammad walked into that cave and invented Islam.
You give us money or we kill you.
Yeah, but they have one of their 5 pillars. It's give money to the poor. Well, it's interesting because in the Middle East, there's only 2 classes. There's the exceedingly wealthy and the immensely poor. And I don't see, then again, I'm not in that part of the world, where the immensely wealthy are giving a dime to the incredibly poor.
Yeah. Actually, they do. However, it is not for altruistic purposes. It's to keep the lid on.
Is that it?
Oh, yeah, like the Saudi family. They pour money into their communities
to stay in power.
Because if they didn't, there'd be a popular uprising because everybody would be living in a condition that they might as well risk death by uprising rather than live like that.
Understood.
Yeah.
Anyhow, back to the original part of where we were getting with this. I agree. Some of these laws, be it schools or religious institutions and where things are, we did not get a very popular restaurant in this town because it was too close to the library. Because they were going to serve alcohol. Silly.
County commissioners, listen up. And we'll be back right after these words.
And welcome back. There's a story recently out of Pennsylvania where a judge sentenced a woman. And it's very interesting where this all went on. He had ordered this woman to pay her ex-husband's attorney's fees, to which evidently she didn't pay him fast enough for the judge. So the judge issued a bench warrant for, keep in mind, this has now become a civil issue, not a criminal issue. The judge essentially created a crime, issued a bench warrant for her in the amount of the attorney's fees that the judge ordered her to pay to her ex-husband's attorney.
Can I correct you just a little bit on the narrative?
Okay.
Okay. The bench warrant was for contempt. Not for criminal. What he did is after she was in custody,
because
he keyed into the computer as a criminal matter so that he could get the physical tracking thing on her.
Get the ankle bracelet on her.
I want to make sure the narrative
is
correct.
So after she's in custody, he literally created a criminal offense, which is not on the books.
Yeah, he like put something in the computer saying she committed a crime.
Yeah, which was just arbitrarily created and additional fines, some time in jail, ankle bracelet, all this other garbage.
Ankle bracelet was the big thing. He couldn't do that under the state's law without keying something into the computer saying she had committed a criminal offense.
Right, which he created out of thin air.
Yeah, she had not committed any criminal offense.
And keep in mind, the legislature creates
a law. Or charged with one. She had not been charged
with
any.
Not been charged.
No, less convicted.
Or convicted, didn't go through the process, anything. The judge just said, here's where it is. I'm going to write a law, which is a legislator's job. I'm going to enforce the law, which is the executive's job. And then I'm going to institute the law minus a jury or having gone through any of the other processes. Total abolishment of this. Absolutely no accountability. The judge could do whatever he wants. So the woman's, her attorney sued. That went up through the courts. It recently reached the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in New York.
Let's tell the audience what she sued about. She sued the judge.
The judge, civilly.
Claiming that his conduct was outside the bounds of his judicial duties. For instance, it is not the job of a judge to falsely key in criminal data when there's been no criminal charge, no criminal trial, no criminal verdict. It is not.
And deny you of due process.
It is outside the judge's scope of their job to do that. That he had violated her rights. And there was a third claim, which as we're sitting here talking, I can't remember what it was, but
it egregious enough as it is.
Yes, exactly.
The three-judge panel from the Third Circuit in their ruling.
That he had acted maliciously.
Maliciously, that's right. So the Third Circuit Court wrote a six-page opinion in there, which sums it up to a judge is completely – now, this is within the Third Circuit's district, not out here in the Southwest, but in the Northeast. A judge enjoys complete civil immunity – whether they acted improperly, maliciously, or with poor intent.
Or even outside of their job description.
Outside of their level of authority. They enjoy complete immunity. It even said maliciously, which means a judge can do whatever they want to somebody in their court, and they're completely immune from any sort of civil liability. And there's a couple of standing Supreme Court cases that this is in direct violation of.
No, I'll tell you one very similar to this. True story, probably goes back about, I'm going to guess, 4 or 5 years ago. A man and a woman were getting divorced. Their case is being heard in family court by a family court judge. Okay? Unbeknownst to the husband in this divorce action, the wife and the judge are having sex. And the judge continues to hear the case.
The judge didn't recuse himself.
And just rams the husband.
I'm nailing your wife on the side, and I'm not going to recuse myself.
Or even disclose, okay, kept the whole thing a secret, completely stacked the deck legally for her. She got all of these things to which she was not entitled. And the husband sued the judge, and guess what the appellate court said?
They said you can't sue the judge?
You can sue him. But we're going to throw the case out because he has complete – because judicial immunity is complete.
Yeah. Here's the deal. This is the way I look at this. And this – some people might think this is an extreme view. Some people might just straight agree with me. This is precisely one of the many reasons why the founders instituted the Second Amendment. Because when a government becomes corrupt and unaccountable – and violates everything to do with your rights, my rights, Dave's rights, anybody's rights, all of our rights. The last bastion we have is our right to keep and bear arms, to protect ourselves from a tyrannical government. And this sort of thing from the judicial level is, by definition, tyrannical. Mm-hmm. No way that I could ever sit by and allow this kind of thing to happen.
What did Mao Zedong say? Where does political power come from?
I think he said, tong tang hong tang hong tang. I don't know. He's Chinese. What did he say?
He said, political power grows from the muzzle of a gun.
Okay? Yeah.
I think perhaps one of the most profound statements in history from Mao Zedong of all people. Now, he would know something a little bit about growing political power out of the muzzle of a gun. Yes,
yes? He would.
All right. Now, I'm with Bill on this thing. Okay. This municipal judge who did this thing, I think he should be found not alive. And I think by whatever – and I'm not saying that the victim should do this. Good, righteous American citizens should do this. This judge should end up not alive. and then it should be made public by whoever did it. Not their identity is made public, but the reason is if you, the Third Circuit and other superior courts across the country, will not allow justice to be done for and in the interest of the victims of this wrongful conduct, you shut them out and say, you can have justice all across the government. You can have all across the country. You can get justice against the executive branch. You can get justice against your legislators. You can get justice against your fellow citizens. In all sorts of situations, you can go to court and get justice. Unless the guy's wearing a black dress. If he's wearing a black dress, there's no justice. Then I think it is incumbent upon us to mete out some justice and let them know you could have solved this. You chose not to. We solved it the way we had to.
And I think what this really boils down to, Dave, is we need to have a revamping of what and allow the people to define what justice is and where it belongs, especially when it comes to these government officials. Because right now, for him to be made not alive would then violate some other sorts of legislative things that have been passed on the you got to protect this guy and protect that guy. And those sort of boundaries, in order for this guy to be found not alive, really need to be rescinded and changed so that we are not absolutely hosed. Because what this is someone's absolute liberty was taken away by one person who happened to be in a position that could enact vengeance. So now anywhere in the Third Circuit, any judge of any level, even from the smallest little traffic violation level, those judges have now been given absolute power to do whatever they want maliciously to anybody and everybody that comes into their court and is found under their jurisdictions. They can do whatever they want.
Let's be clear. They can be punished. They can be punished by the Supreme Court of that state. In other words, the bar brings a complaint and it's heard by the Supreme Court.
Or there's a judge panel that looks at the, like we have in Nevada.
Right.
So there are some remedies.
But there's no justice for the victim because the victim is left never being made whole. Which is a very important principle in civil law. When you've been injured, when you've been damaged, the ability to go after the person who injured or damaged you, and if a jury agrees with you, then they have to make you whole, or something akin to that. That's one of the principal elements of justice within the civil courts. And the way it's working now is there is that element being made whole has been completely eviscerated.
Absolutely.
So if we can't be made whole, maybe they need holes.
imagine, if you will, you park in a handicapped spot and the little handicapped thing that hangs over your rearview mirror falls down. The cop doesn't see it. You get cited. You go to court. You plead not guilty. Hey, here's how it was. And the judge is having a bad day and says, you know what? If the thing isn't hanging up in there, then you ought to go get yourself a new one. That's your responsibility. Now you're going to pay a fine. It's going to be $6 million. You're going to do 60 years in prison, all in solitary confinement. Because now, based on this ruling, they could legitimately do that. Now, you'd have to fight that on appeal, but what do you do from that moment?
Right, and why should you have to spend tens of thousands of dollars for an appellate attorney to sort something out because a guy in a black dress or a gal in a black dress was a sphincter.
And what's the judge's defense? Oh, here's a ruling. This is why I can do this.
And what we're talking about is one small aspect of a broader problem, which you and I talk about often, which is any group that has some sort of power policing themselves. We talk about, you know, the criminals with badges and the
medical industry, policing industry, the legislators, judges, all of it.
Yes. And the very notion that these people can police themselves is absurd. So you and I have talked about many times that we, despite the screams of panic and heartache by cops when you say somebody needs to judge you other than your fellow cops, okay, you and I have often said, cops judging cops, that has run its time. It should be over.
Yeah, a long time ago.
This is just a manifestation of the same principle. The idea that people wearing black dresses sitting up on a dais should be able to judge their fellow black dress wearers who sit up on a dais is absurd. The idea that anyone could possibly have an expectation of justice when the wrongdoers are judging themselves, this is like me, you judging me this week and me judging you next week. How do people imagine this is going to turn out?
It's a circle jerk is what it is. It's a judicial circle jerk. And, you know, it concerns me that the Supreme Court has actually said in the past that the judges and anybody in government, they assume civil liability if they violate your rights or do something wrong. This ruling out of the Third Circuit is completely at odds with this. And I'm afraid if it goes to the Supreme Court, they might reverse a decision.
Yeah, because it seems like they're heading in that direction. I've seen in a number of cases over the last 25 years or so, 30 years, where they've taken these small bites away from the earlier decisions you're talking about, where judges could be held accountable for violation of your unalienable rights, because it's presumed judges are trained and schooled in the law know better.
You'd think, but there has to be some sort of oversight on it, and it maybe should come down to we the people.
And the oversight needs to be us. I'm sorry, did I say that?
That's what the founders allowed for. Folks, right. See us at totallyunprepared.info and email us at daveandbillshow@gmail.com.
See you
be
next
back
week.
Next week.